Hello everyone and welcome to the Software Crafts episode. I'm your host João and with you today we have Joanna Rothman. Joanna Rothman is also known as the Pragmatic Manager, offers frank advice for your thought problems. She helps leaders and teams to do reasonable things that work. Equipped with that knowledge, they can decide how to adapt their product development. With her trademark, practicality and humor, Joanna is the author of 18 books about many aspects of product development. Her most recent books are the Modern Management Made Easy series, From Chaos to Successful Distributed Agile Teams, and Create Your Successful Agile Project. Find the Pragmatic Manager, a monthly email newsletter, and her blogs at jrothman.com and createadaptablelife.com. Hi, Joanna, and thanks for your time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. I am delighted to be here.
Thanks. That is good to hear. So moving to the heuristic, and I imagine that today we're going to have lots to discuss. The heuristic is get the team in a rhythm. What is your experience with this heuristic?
So when I think about a team rhythm, I think in several layers. The first, for the feature or the product team, yes, I want a team rhythm of deliverables. How can we deliver something every day, maybe every other day, mostly so we can see it for feedback? So the first feedback loop is to ourselves. The second feedback loop might be with a customer or with a user. And the third feedback loop is, what does this tell us about the product so we can change where the product is going? And all that is at the team level. Now, if you have feedback loops in a team rhythm such that you can really see the changes in the product as you create it, you can then create another set of feedback loops, one for the overall product backlog, and the second for the project portfolio. I guess I should say that that would be the third, right? So first, feedback loops inside the team. The team has a rhythm of delivering frequently. I like every day or every other day. Based on that knowledge, we can use that feedback to have a rhythm of grading and refining the overall product backlog of what we will do and not do. And then what we will do inside the organization is the third feedback loop and rhythm. And of course, you cannot change what the organization can and cannot do at the project portfolio level faster than any team can deliver.
Very interesting. And thanks to dissect this heuristic, right? And explaining how this can play at different layers. And when you were explaining, everything makes sense to me. And I was thinking about my experience in the past. And I experienced several times that the feedback cycles could be broken on the three layers that you describe. So in this case, where the feedback cycles are broken or the feedback is not going back and forward, where should I start fixing the feedback cycles? In which layer?
I would almost always say at the project portfolio layer, because that's where I see organizational WIP, the work in progress, is way too high. And the reason that the WIP is way too high is because often, not always, but often, because every single manager is out for him or herself, right? The managers have specific individual goals. So the managers are not operating as a team. And because a team has one goal, and when the managers kind of break that team-based goal idea, now their rhythm for the project portfolio is probably broken. And worst of all, really worst of all, is that the every single person that any given manager leads has a different objective than all the other people possibly on the team. So the team no longer has a team goal, and that makes creating small stories that everybody agrees, yes, we're going to do this in roughly this order for this period of time, that makes teamwork almost impossible.
I see, and it's a good one in my opinion, because recently I had a talk with someone describing a similar problem, you know, teams of managers, or in this case a team of team leads. What is the identity of that person? Is it in the team of team leads or the team that leads, right? And I think that you explained the same thing, but you were talking about objectives. We have some managers with different objectives that should play as a team. So, and for this case, because I'm very, as we were discussing on off, I'm attracted by social technical systems and how to manage them and how to encourage them to move. How can we help this team of managers to work as a team, not as a group of individuals with some disparate goals?
So for me, it all goes back to the overarching goal. So you had just spoken about a cohort-based team. If that team of team leads has a goal of removing impediments for the people that they lead and serve, which might be their quote only goal, but is a very valuable goal, right? They don't have to have a delivery objective as long as they have an objective that would lead and serve the people that they... Okay, that was kind of a backward sentence. As long as their objective helps them lead and serve in ways that frees the teams and the team members to do their best work, right? That would be an objective of a cohort-based team. I am very fond of cohort-based teams where we take people at various levels of the hierarchy, because I'm not sure we're ever going to get rid of the hierarchy. We make hierarchies even if we don't have them. So I'm not sure we can ever get rid of them. However, we talk about the senior leadership team, right? Almost every company says, here's who is on our senior leadership team. And in agile organizations, we talk about the feature teams or the product teams or the cross-functional teams. And who are all those people in the middle? Don't they get their teams? That's one of the reasons I really like cohort-based teams with possibly an objective that's almost always an objective that's not a delivery-focused objective. So the middle managers would have an objective of refining the project portfolio. Can they do that without senior leadership? Probably not. They probably have to have some kind of interaction with senior leadership on a regular basis, which goes back to our rhythm. However, does senior leadership always need to manage the project portfolio? Mm-hmm. Maybe, maybe not. That's an it depends answer. And it often depends on the size of the organization and how much the senior leadership needs to talk with the customers and really understand what problems do we want to solve for which customers. If senior leadership focuses on strategy and explains to middle management what the strategy is for now, middle management can actually do the project portfolio work with the guidance of senior leadership, but not with them all the time, which allows middle management to create this team rhythm based on the objectives, right? Who do we want to serve? What problems do we want to solve? And now the middle managers can help and support, I should say, the first line managers in really creating great teams that can really deliver as a team. So for me, this whole notion of team rhythm goes up and down the organization, but it's not based on deliverables. Only the real deliverables that a customer could see are all in the product teams and the feature teams, those cross-functional teams.
Yeah, and I really like about your explanation. So I share the same opinion as you, and the same beliefs in this case, right? The starting with the hierarchy, I don't think that also will disappear. That is because if we look right for the animal kingdom, every other species have some kind of hierarchy. Usually based on brute force. I'm the strongest one, okay, I'm the king, right? This is usually how it plays with other species, but I will say that is ingrained in our DNA, some kind of hierarchy, right? What I really like is this notion that software is different, right? Software is not pure manufacturing, but software also is not pure creativity like music or right, is something in between that we are still defining. And I really like this idea. Okay, we have an hierarchy, vary from, you know, a manufacturing plant, but then we have these cohorts, these different goals, and be clear with them and helping people understand works. And I also like the way that you put the it depends, because, okay, here comes an heuristic. Every time that I hear it depends is an heuristic. And this podcast starts with an heuristic. And you talk about the size of the organization. So my question is, in your experience, what is the size of the organization when senior leadership is more involved with product portfolio management or is less involved? What is the boundaries for that threshold?
So in my experience, the small startups, and I'm going to talk about the number of people, not the dollar revenue. So up to about 99 people, maybe a couple hundred. I have not seen it really with more than a little over 100. So I often think of nines, right? 99 people. So 9 people in a team is tolerable. 10 people is not. So 99 people for me, and this is another heuristic, right? So 99 people in an organization, and maybe up to 120 or something, is the senior leadership needs to be involved in many, many, many decisions, especially about the project portfolio. They really need to say, we need to pivot now. We need to change. We're changing our customers. We're changing the problems we solve. So that pivoting thing happens a lot in smaller organizations. Now, what about a few hundred people? I think that's where we get to not so much where the senior leaders are hands-off for the project portfolio, but they are not as hands-on. And what happens between 99 and, say, 299 people? I don't know. That really depends. It really depends on how much you need to pivot. It depends on how much it's a matter of delivery as opposed to discovery. Right? You might be discovering your strategy. You might be discovering your market. You might be creating a new market. The more you are in discovery kinds of mode, the more the senior leadership needs to be involved in the project portfolio, because there's a feedback loop between the project portfolio and what the customers see. And that feedback loop needs to be shorter so that the organization can pivot. My experience is that once you get to about maybe 300 to 1,000 people, senior leadership needs to be less hands-on, but still setting the strategy, still setting the direction, still talking with customers at a much higher level than product people or teams would, right? So they are talking about strategy with customers, not so much this particular product and feedback about this particular product. So, and then once you get to 1,000 people or more, I think it's really hard for senior leadership to do their jobs and not interfere with the project portfolio decisions.
Yeah, thanks to show how your experience goes, right? And I also see parallels with the theory of Elliot Jacks, the levels of work, so the versus the time. And I see the parallels as you get bigger, especially in our industry, right, with digital products. If you get to those numbers, 1,000, it probably means that you have several business units. I'm thinking about a bank, right, with a private banking and commercial banking and whatsoever, right? That's why you scale massively. And in that case, CEO is talking with the ministry, right, the government. It's her or his job to do that, right? Not to manage a portfolio. So this is very interesting. And you use two words, start with D, that are very, very interesting. And I think that usually companies or teams are to one or the other, discover versus delivery, right? And time for that. And I'm curious, before we deep dive in modes of discovering and modes of delivery, because we are talking about managers, what are the conditions or the principles to have an organization that can discover and delivery? And, you know, between these two modes, what are the conditions that a manager or a group of managers, a cohort, needs to create for an organization to move on without they being involved on everyday task? Imagine that is an organization with 300 people, right?
So that's where we need to encourage experiments of learning across the entire organization. So I find that there's a whole bunch of psychological safety where we can all admit that we don't know or that we made a mistake and that we need help. All that stuff is part of psychological safety. But if we want to discover and deliver, not literally at the same time, but not have a team of people who discover and a different team of people who deliver, then we need to really encourage experiments of learning. And I mean, there might be another way to do this. I don't know of another way to do this.
And when you talk about the experimentation learning to avoid, you know, a part of the organization that discovers and a part of the organization that delivers, how does experiment or encourage the experiments from a manager's point of view, how they will look up with feedback cycles that in the beginning we talk about with the team's rhythm, right? Getting the rhythm, how that can be managed? Because I see the cycles of a team is a smaller and then the feedback on the other layers, it's a big one. So how can we balance these?
So this is where I really like to look for outcomes, but sometimes outcomes are answers to questions or more questions, right? So for delivery, I think that we all understand it's something a person can use in some way. Maybe it answers a question for a user or a customer. But the more we have of discovery, the more we need to say we either generate more questions or we answer some questions. So I really like experiments where I am not going to succeed, because that allows me to prune the decision tree, right? If I have all these possible ways of going forward, I need to start pruning. And I can do a thought experiment for what might work and what might not work. But I am always wrong. So I've written a bunch of books. And I love all my books. I never know until I actually publish it and get it out there which books will sell the best. And right now, as we are recording this, my best-selling book was the one that my original publisher rejected. And why did they reject it? Because it wasn't right for their audience. So it's been right for lots and lots and lots of other people, but not for their audience. And that's, if I had said, oh, they just don't want the book, it's not very good, I would never have known that that book would be my best-selling book. Never, never in a million years. So this is why it's so important to choose your audience and solve problems for them, right? So you are part of a larger firm, and that firm decides on the audience and who do you want to serve, right? Your customers, and what problems do you want to serve them? How do you want to serve them? Which problems do you solve? And until you decide that, and every organization needs to decide that, until we all decide that for ourselves, we have the open universe of possibilities. That's too big. We need to somehow prune our decisions. So I don't write about, for example, how to do TDD. I have experienced TDD in several ways. I use what I call question-driven writing for my books, but that's not the same as test-driven development. So I don't write about that because it's not firmly in my wheelhouse. Those are not the problems I solve. However, I do solve agile management problems. And that's why I wrote the Modern Management Made Easy books. But that's why I choose which problems I want to solve for whom. And every single person needs to do that for themselves. I am sure that that's why when we say, well, there's just no cultural fit with this person, it's about the fit of the products and the environment, not just the culture with the person. It's also about the person also, but that's a different problem. But that's why when we think about what we need to do as teams, as product people, as project portfolio people, as senior leadership, we need to prune the decision tree in some ways, and experiments that fail, those actually help us prune the decision tree, as opposed to a thought experiment. We're all really great at thought experiments. Yeah.
We probably are. And I just love the prune decision tree. I'm going to start using it because I really like, okay, we have a decision tree, and because it's a tree, we prune it, because I love the gardener example. As a manager, you just help the garden not to go off, but let it go, right? I really love the prune decision tree. And you, lots of ideas, and now I get lost. Getting back on track, last thing you talk about, a very interesting one, the cultural fit, that usually people use this as an argument, but actually is the intersection about product, technology, people, the audience, all of these, and doesn't work. Why do we use the argument of a cultural fit rather than to look to this intersection of all of these dimensions? Because we try something easy, or we are not aware of complexity.
Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit of a rant here.
I love rants.
Okay, we too often hire people who are just like ourselves. And when we use the words cultural fit, we often mean comfortable with. So I am a short woman. I am 5 feet tall on a very, very good day. Right. So I'm short. And when I was about 40, I was ready for a senior leadership position. I was ready to be a CIO or a VP of engineering. I had paid my dues. I was in, not in only for some kinds of organizations, right? Not every single organization, but the kinds of organizations I really wanted to work in, which were engineering focused, hardware, software, firmware, that kind of product-based focus. I was a great program manager. I've been a director for several years. I was ready. And I tried to find a job as a VP, and nobody would hire me. Nobody. They offered me director-level jobs. And when I asked one of the senior leaders, he said, I just cannot imagine golfing with you. I said, is golfing part of the job? He said, well, that's what we do here as a senior leadership team. I said, do you think I cannot learn how to golf? He said, your legs are too short. I mean, this is stuff that has nothing to do with the job, but he was talking about his comfort with me. And that's an extreme example, which is why I actually started my consulting business, because I figured these people really need me, but they are much more likely to need me as a consultant rather than as a direct employee. And I've been right so far. That was 26 years ago. So what I find is that we often use cultural fit as a synonym for comfort with, as opposed to what cultural fit really is. If we use Edgar Schein's artifacts, values, assumptions, all that stuff, I boil it down to, what do we choose to talk about? What's acceptable for us to talk about? How do we treat each other? And what do we reward? And if we use those three things, and if we have a person who is unable to manage their temper, that's part of how we treat each other. And we might say that person either is or is not a cultural fit. I've been in organizations where people yelled at each other, seemed like they were having fights all the time. And then they would, after they got to a decision, they all laughed and said, let's go have a beer. That was how they came to decisions. I've also worked in organizations where the senior leader said his or her decision and everybody fell right into line. I've worked in other organizations where the senior leader held back their decisions and heard from everybody and then said, I hear you all, and now this is my decision. Three different ways of coming to a decision. None of them are right and none of them are wrong. How can we be successful in how we treat each other and what we can discuss? And that's just one thing, never mind what we reward. So when we think about cultural fit, I would really like people to start thinking about, are you talking about comfort with or actual real culture? What we can discuss, how people treat each other, and especially what we reward.
I want to thank you because I think that this is not rant. This is just the naked reality. And I usually call these, because I'm a tall white guy, right? The only thing that I miss from the Wheel of Power is that English is not my native language, right? So, you know, the Wheel of Power, I score everything except English and my native language. So I know all my privilege. And I also call, especially these interviews, it's what I call the cloning pattern. Especially when I have customers, oh, we don't innovate. And I, well, okay, look around. You are just hiring people like you. So how do we want to innovate without people that just think a little bit different, right? That has a different experience on life that, you know, whatever. So when I call that the cloning pattern, so I think that we are talking about the same. And once again, thank you, because this is not a ranking, it's a reality. And then I can imagine, well, you are very successful, right? Because you went to your goal. These people need you. And here we are, right, with 18 books after and great advice. Even with the principles that we were talking about, or you were talking about two of them before. Now, I will like to tease your brain, because also you were in the Agile Alliance community and early days of Agile. So I'm going to throw a sentence. I don't know if you're going to like me or not. But I read somewhere that Agile started as a movement against bad management. And now you are talking about Agile management, right? So how do you feel about this statement that Agile was against bad management?
So I think that a lot of the Agile, well, certainly the Agile Manifesto for Software Development started as a way to push back against command and control management, especially command and control project management, which always strikes me funny because I had met Alistair. Oh, I'd already known him for several years, and he did not invite me to Snowbird, and he did invite, which is fine, right? I mean, how many people were you actually going to invite? He did invite Jim Highsmith, and Jim had written this wonderful, is it called Adaptive Project Management? I don't remember the title of Jim's first kind of agile project management book. I just don't remember the name of it. And I think a lot of us at the time, and I include myself in this movement, in this early movement. I was talking about rolling wave planning as opposed to trying and planning the entire thing up front back in 97. I talked about release criteria and milestone criteria, and that you could not have phase milestones. You could say for requirement X, Y, or Z, the requirement is done, the architecture is done, the design is done, the code is done, the tests are done. And that's how you know that requirement is done, that as opposed to phases being done. I often said, even back in the 80s, and this is in my early writing, which is sometimes a little hard to read because I was a new writer then, that we would know what we shipped when we actually put the product on the disk, because we were shipping back on disk back in the 80s and the 90s. So I think that in my experience, the rise of software project management software, right? The ways you could look at a project, and especially Microsoft project, which is just one example of it, right? There are plenty of other project management tools. That gave rise to a whole bunch of command and control, but because people needed to know, when will it be done? And that was, a lot of people thought that putting a project schedule together was the way you would know it would be done. And I knew that that was never the way you were going to finish it. That might be the way you start thinking about it. We think we're going to do this feature first, this feature second, this feature third. And I remember talking about critical paths at some point in the early O's or maybe the late 90s. And somebody said to me, Johanna, how do you find the critical path for a software project? I said, you don't. It changes every single day. As soon as somebody finishes something, the critical path changes. So why would you put yourself through all that aggravation? Because my project scheduling tool requires it. This is not an answer. So I think that the Agile movement started as much more than a reflex against bad command and control project management. And I think also a lot of bad project portfolio management. We have had the too much WIP, work in progress problem, as long as I have been in this field.
Yeah. So thanks for this. So it's a lovely conversation. You get back to the origin of Agile. I was expecting this. That's why I tease you. And also, now I know where Kent Beck learned. So 2 years ago, yes, 2020, before the pandemic really hits everything, we had DDD Europe here in Amsterdam, and Kent was talking. And Kent was talking about an amazing heuristic. Every time that the software comes to be, changes itself. Right? That is exactly what you are saying. Now I know where he learns that, because both of you were on the same community. You explain with critical path. And I think that this is what we were talking. We were used to manufacturing. What comes out of the factory, it's the product. Good luck or bad luck, it's the product. And then you talk about shipping stuff in an artifact, a CD or floppy disks. But once the network evolve, and namely we have the cloud, we could leverage software. That is, I don't like this, I change it. And it changed in a few seconds, push out. And I believe that as a community, we are still to these old concepts. My project management tool needs it. And I also believe that's why project management got a bad reputation. Because sometimes you need to manage projects, not products, right? Because you just need to do something. Oh, I don't know your perception there, but oh, now we have GDPR in Europe. It's a project in itself until becomes embedded in the product. This is what I talk to my customers. So very happy that you gave the background. So long rant on my part. You gave the background for Kent's thought. It's the critical path.
So I will say, I am sure that Kent and I came up with that at the same time, separately, right? I have learned a lot from Kent. I'm not sure if he even knows who I am, but when all of us see this and we see the same issue from our very different perspectives, we might come up with different words, but we all say roughly the same thing. That's there's a word for that. Oh, it's simultaneous discovery or something like that, where if you have a lot of really great minds, or at least a lot of minds working on roughly the same problem, they see it in different dimensions and they all come up with roughly similar solutions.
I do believe that, and I do believe that the Agile movement, although your name is not there, and by the way, Rebecca was my first guest for obvious reasons, right? She's the heuristics lady. Also, her name is not there. Although she is close to anything that involves patterns and heuristics, she was close to the DDD community in the beginning. She was close to all communities with heuristics. But anyway, I do believe that is very brilliant people at the same time looking to the same problem, right? Yourself, Rebecca, you talk about Alistair, Kent, Martin Fowler, right? All at the same time, because even in the second edition of the refactoring book, Martin Fowler says that. I'm writing this book because back in the day, Kent Beck was too busy developing JUnit and TDD. That's why. So I imagine that community at back then just called different stuff and in the end wrote what I call the different views over a cube, right? If we imagine a cube, we are looking to this problem from different views, which is amazing. And I'm inspired now by Jessica Kerr. She talks about the another point, that is when all those folks 10 years ago, given or taking, was at ThoughtWorks. Also Martin Fowler, but the people with microservices and continuous delivery and trunk-based development, somehow, at the same point in time, they coexist in the same company, which make booming again software industry. And now I'm very curious for the next one, the next 5 years, gonna happen.
Jessica introduced me to the word semathesy, which now that I know the word is exactly what I want. I want it and I have created it. I have created it as a person inside the organization. I've created it as a consultant. I try and create it with my clients, my coaching clients, my trusted advisor clients. I mean, if I can work with people, and this is my heuristic, the more we learn together, the better we all are.
Definitely, definitely. The word from Jessica really summarize it. And I also do believe I had Kent Power a few episodes back talking about this. How do we learn as an organization and as individuals? And it's about this. The innovation not only comes from diversity, right? Because it's the almost a prerequisite. But then what are the constraints in the environment that allows learning to be there or not to be there, right? Which is a very, very interesting topic, how to get there. So learning together is definitely the way forward. Mm-hmm. All right, so the time just flies. I'm loving talking with you, but we already crossed the half an hour mark. I do believe that we need to record another episode because this is too short. But the typical questions that my audience already knows what comes there, that is, what are the resources that you recommend so people can deep dive on some subjects or go left or right on some subjects? What do you recommend to the audience?
So the Modern Management Made Easy books talk a lot about these kinds of ideas. And so certainly there. I have a blog post about the various levels of feedback loops, which I will send you the URL so you can put it with the show notes. Because that's it happens to be my first attempt at showing the various feedback loops, but I think it's at least reasonable, if not firm for now. And my hiring book, Hiring Geeks That Fit. If you want to know more about hiring for culture, that's the book to read. If I had known more about how to title books, I would have changed the title, but I didn't, and I'm not. I don't often go backwards for books. I tend to go forwards. It was my best work at the time, and I just keep going. Certainly, the whole notion of Sympathy and Nora Bateson's essay, I think, is really useful. I will also give you that link.
All right,
And I'm
thanks.
not sure.
Yeah, so
Thank you.
thanks. I will make sure that, as you said already, all of these resources are on the notes. And also, if you want to challenge Joanna, I also will add the social media, so you can always find her and challenge any concept, ask anything. That's why we are here. Sharing is caring. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Can follow us on Twitter at scraftspodcast, visit our website softwarecraftspodcast.com, or follow our page on LinkedIn. Hope to see you next week.